Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The Navy is conducting public information sessions up and down the West Coast, informing citizens and taking comment about their plans to continue using Northwest offshore waters for a wide range of training and practice, including the use of sonar. A lawsuit has been filed against the Navy saying its use of sonar violates the Marine Mammal Protection Act. John Mosier is in charge of the Navy's environmental review.
We're certainly not out there just blindly doing the training without any regard for the environment. There are hundreds of people doing what I do, and that's ensuring that we're doing everything we can to protect the environment while we do that very important mission.
Liam Moriarty reports on the concerns over the use of sonar and the mitigation measures the Navy is proposing. That story coming up in about 5 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Active sonar is the Navy's best weapon to detect the presence of hostile submarines. But that same powerful underwater pulse of sound can harm or even kill whales and other marine mammals. Now the Navy is seeking permission to continue using a huge swath of the Northwest coast from Northern California to the Canadian border for a wide range of naval training and practice, including sonar. The Navy says it's taking precautions to protect whales, but as Liam Moriarty reports, others say the precautions are not enough.
On May 5th, 2003, Ken Balcom noticed something very strange in Harrow Strait, a body of water along the U.S.-Canadian border in Washington State.
All the porpoises and the minke whales and the killer whales were fleeing the area.
Balcom is senior scientist and director at the Center for Whale Research on San Juan Island in Washington. He says the animals looked like they were frantically trying to escape something. Some of the local killer whales, he says,
came right along the shoreline, directly in front of my house, and then it looked as though they were going to strand on the beach at my house.
At the same time, a deafening sound was picked up by underwater microphones used by researchers to record killer whale vocalizations. A Navy destroyer, the USS Shoup, was using active sonar as part of an exercise in Harrow Strait, generating pulses of 140 decibels or more. That's as loud as standing near a fighter jet during takeoff. In the following days, at least 10 harbor porpoises were found dead in the area, some with blood coming from their heads. Some frozen bodies were sent for analysis, but it couldn't be conclusively determined if the sonar contributed to the deaths. For Ken Balcom, it felt like deja vu. 3 years earlier, he'd studied a mass stranding of dolphins following a Navy sonar exercise in the Bahamas. Balcom says he suspected the intense pressure of the sonar pulses played a role.
So I collected and froze heads and took them to Harvard Medical School, and we CAT scanned them, showed that they had hemorrhagic damage and in the brain and ears.
These incidents and others like them led to limitations on how and where the Navy can conduct sonar exercises. Now, as the Navy seeks to renew permits to train and test in the Northwest, it's trying to minimize the harm to marine mammals. John Mosier is in charge of the Navy's environmental review of the project. He says the plan is to have trained lookouts keep an eye out for whales.
Their job is to look for marine life, and if any is detected, to notify those people on the ship that are operating those systems and operating the ship.
If animals are spotted, sonar testing could be delayed till they left the area. Mosier says the Navy is very concerned about its impact on wildlife.
We're certainly not out there just blindly doing the training without any regard for the environment. There are hundreds of people doing what I do, and that's ensuring that we're doing everything we can to protect the environment while we do that very important mission.
Mosier says that mission, protecting the nation, requires that sailors train and practice frequently.
These are skills that are not easy. They are perishable and can be lost over time, so continual training is an absolute necessity.
But Zach Smith, an attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, says the government could do a lot more to reduce the threat to whales. He says the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is responsible for marine mammal protection, has let the Navy off easy.
Here they have consistently taken no steps to keep the Navy out of areas that are high in density for marine mammals.
The Natural Resources Defense Council has been in court for several years, trying to force the government to put stricter limits on the Navy's use of sonar in coastal waters where whales are present. Smith points to documents in which the Navy concedes that, despite its efforts to avoid harm, it expects to impact marine mammals hundreds of thousands of times over the 5-year permit period. He says that shows the effect of the Navy's safety measures is limited.
And that limitation is it only really works to limit the most serious harm.
Smith says the number of whales and other marine mammals outright killed or permanently deafened may be decreased by the lookouts and other Navy precautions, but other impacts that damage the animal's ability to feed or reproduce won't.
Temporary hearing loss will continue. Behavioral disruption will continue. And their lookout regime doesn't do anything to limit that.
Smith says the Navy should be restricted from using sonar during times of the year when seasonal migrations bring concentrations of whales into coastal waters. Ken Balcom with the Center for Whale Research agrees. For example, he says, the Northwest's endangered orca whales typically spend May through October in the inside waters near Puget Sound and Georgia Strait.
Likewise, the migrations of gray whales and blue whales, fin whales. We know the productivity areas that they visit. These should be taken into account.
The Navy says that to maintain combat readiness, its personnel must be able to train in all areas, in all seasons. The Navy is holding a series of public meetings on the environmental impact statement for the Northwest Training and Testing Area. Meetings will be held in communities from Oak Harbor, Washington, to Fort Bragg, California. The deadline for comment is March 25th. I'm Liam Moriarty, reporting.
An open house information session with Navy representatives will take place in Astoria on Monday, March 3rd at the Astoria High School Student Commons from 5 to 8 p.m. That's at 1001 West Marine Drive. Public comment will be taken at the meeting. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, 2014 seems like the year of the minimum wage from President Obama in his State of the Union address.
A fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour.
To Washington Governor Inslee's State of the State speech.
A statewide increase in our minimum wage.
The national concern with income inequality has resonated with efforts to boost the minimum wage in the Northwest. Austin Jenkins reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, rain at times. Southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. The chance of rain, 90%. Rainfall amounts around a tenth of an inch, with high temperatures near 50 degrees. Then tonight, cloudy. A 50% chance of showers as overnight lows 40 to 45. We're hearing a lot these days about raising the minimum wage. President Obama talked about it in his State of the Union address last month. SeaTac Washington voters approved a $15 an hour base wage last fall. And there's a push now to adopt the same in Seattle. Even in Idaho, there's a minimum wage campaign afoot. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on a national effort to put the issue before politicians and voters.
It's been more than 2 years since the Occupy Wall Street movement grabbed headlines. Here in Washington, protesters set up camp near the Capitol and disrupted the legislature.
We are the 99%!
For a couple of months, the occupiers were part of the scene in Olympia. Then riot gear-clad Washington State troopers swept into their tent city and sent them packing.
You are directed to remove tents, shelters, structures.
The occupiers mostly went quietly into that morning, but they had left their imprint. In Olympia and across the nation, 99% was now shorthand for income inequality. But David Rolfe of the Service Employees International Union says there was something missing.
Occupy didn't have a long-term theory of how to make change, and it didn't have very crisp demands.
Rolfe says that started to change about a year after the occupiers were chased out. In November of 2012, his union, SEIU, was involved in organizing a fast food workers' strike in New York. Their demand? A $15 an hour wage. In May of 2013, SEIU helped organize a similar action in Seattle. Como TV showed the boisterous walkout.
Walkout!
Fast food workers would again walk out nationally in August of 2013. SEIU's David Rolfe believes these strikes were the catalyst for the current push for higher minimum wages.
The momentum is clearly towards a broad movement in this country to address income inequality, and a low-hanging piece of fruit in that struggle is the demand to increase wages.
Now, suddenly, 2014 seemed like the year of the minimum wage, from President Obama in his State of the Union,
a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour,
to Washington Governor Jay Inslee in his State of the State.
Statewide increase in our minimum wage.
In the city of Seattle, the political battle is less whether to raise the base wage, but by how much and how quickly. Newly elected Mayor Ed Murray has appointed a task force to examine the issue. This year, minimum wage measures have been introduced or are in play in some 30 state capitals across the nation. Leslie McCall is an expert on income inequality at Northwestern University. She's not surprised the left has seized upon the minimum wage.
You know, it's a long-standing policy that we actually have in place already.
And it polls well. McCall says historically the minimum wage becomes an issue during economic recoveries when not everyone is bouncing back.
To me, it seems quite consistent with the past, not something that's sort of drummed up, but that is a genuine reflection of frustrations and frustrated expectations about economic growth.
There's another professor who views this minimum wage movement very differently. Matt Manweller teaches political science at Central Washington University. He's also a Republican state lawmaker.
It's in no way a coincidence that President Barack Obama makes minimum wage an issue, then Governor Inslee makes it an issue, and then Mayor Ed Murray makes it an issue.
Manweller believes it's part of a coordinated campaign. Personally, he opposes raising the minimum wage, but he views the issue as more populist than liberal.
If the economy rebounds, then I think it will take the wind out of the sails. If it continues to stagnate, then populist messages will continue to resonate.
SEIU is there to make sure they do. Democratic State Representative Jessen Farrell recalls a conversation she had last fall with an SEIU lobbyist.
We were just kind of off to the side, but saying this was a really exciting vote.
She's talking about the vote in the city of SeaTac to raise the minimum wage there to $15 an hour.
This was so exciting that, you know, the momentum around this campaign of fast food workers has caught on fire. You know, should we consider doing this?
Doing this meant introduce a bill in the legislature to raise Washington's minimum wage, already the highest in the nation. The answer was yes.
We are here to introduce House Bill 2672, which would raise the statewide minimum wage.
Last month, Farrell announced a proposal to boost Washington's base wage to $12 an hour by 2017. But her proposal appears stalled. Turns out some of her fellow Democrats are wary. But SEIU and other advocates for low-wage workers say the issue isn't going away, and there's talk of an initiative to the people. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
In related news, Clatsop Community College will present the film Inequality for All tomorrow night at 6:30 at the college's Performing Arts Center, 588 16th Street in Astoria. The film explores how individuals can take incremental steps towards structural change in our economy. One thing we can do for our own personal economies is to grow at least a portion of our own food. Both personal and market gardening is on the rise in our region. This weekend, master gardeners are partnering with the Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum in Ilwaukee, Washington, for some hands-on educational outreach. We're here in the studio this morning with Bev Arnoldy and Carly Rupp. They are both WSU Master Gardeners, and we're going to hear about some super soils and an opportunity that you will have to engage in making super soils yourself. Good morning, Kelly and Bev.
Good morning.
Well, you're partnering with the Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum, and this is an ongoing project?
That's right. The Columbia Pacific Heritage Museum has a what we call a pocket garden called the Discovery Garden that was created in 2005 to celebrate the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. And I'd like to say that the garden has suffered from benign neglect over the years. And the WSU Master Gardeners of Pacific County were looking for a project that we could focus on doing what we do as Master Gardeners. We talked to the executive director of the museum, Betsy Millard, and we have joined with them in partnership. We have a agreement with them. It started in 2012. Our first year was in 2013. We had 4 workshops that we sponsored there. They were very successful. We were able to improve parts of the garden. Because we are such a small group, we decided that it would be a multi-year project, and each year we would focus on certain areas of the garden. Last year we focused on the most obvious areas, the entrances of the garden, plus we added a rain collection system, which helps with the water bills for the garden as well, because it has a pond. So this year we're focusing on soils, the pond itself, container gardening, and native plants. So we have scheduled 4 workshops throughout the year. The first one for this season is this coming Saturday on super soils.
Okay, well, let's get right down to the nitty-gritty dirty of the thing. The soils in our maritime climate are leached by all our rain, so we lose water-soluble nutrients and minerals. How can we combat that problem?
So indeed, you know, what we have here, you know, in the Pacific region is so much rain. We leach so many of the water-soluble nutrients. So a big part of what we're going to be doing at the workshop on Saturday is building up a basic understanding of what soils are all about here, how to nurture them over the years, right? And make sure that, you know, you're actually building the best tilth possible, you know, for your garden area.
Could you explain what tilth is?
Soil tilth. I love that word, right? You know, when it really talks about the condition of the soil, as most appropriate for planting and growing something. So you want to have healthy soil tilth, and you can improve your soil tilth by amendments to your soils, of course, as, you know, over time. So some of the things we're going to be doing at this Saturday include sampling the soil, teaching folks how to take soil tests, how to actually use simple implements to build little soil augers so as to get proper soil, you know, at samples, and how native plants, you know, can actually be used to actually restore soils in a very simple and easy to handle manner.
The auger that you were picking up there looked like it was made out of plastic pipe.
Indeed. One of the simple things we'll be showing here is how to actually use very inexpensive, readily available tools to create a soil auger. And so what I'm holding here in the studio is a 3/4-inch PVC pipe, you know, with a little wedge cut out of it and a little T section at the top to make a handle, which, when inserted into the soil, can actually be used to gather proper, clean soil samples for your soil test. Because, as you alluded to, the leaching we have here causes tremendous nutrient deficiencies and nutrient accumulations of unwanted, you know, in some cases, minerals. So soil testing is very important, and we'll talk about that again at the workshop in terms of simple ways to do your pH testing to test for your acid or your alkalinity in the soils, and then simple ways to manage your amendments through compost and mulch, as well as proper fertilizing.
Amendments run the gamut from the compost you can make yourself to seed meal or agricultural lime you can purchase. How does a novice gardener know which amendments to use and in what quantities they're needed?
Do be thinking about, you know, the kind of plants that you want to grow, you know, and so, you know, what do you actually want to have in your garden? Is it food plants? Is it landscape material? Is it trees, right? All of these materials, all of these plant materials do have different desires for different nutrient mixes. And so one of the first things to understand is think about what you're trying to grow. Match that against the soil, you know, pH that is most desirable for those plants. And do a little research, do a little study in terms of, you know, what kind of nutrients the plant needs during its growing cycle. You know, and so that, of course, varies between the time you either plant a seedling or a seed versus the time at which it has rapid plant growth, you know, and which is when it put on fruit. For example, nitrogen, of course, is one of the primary nutrients, one of the 14 essential nutrients that is required, you know, for plants, and it is the element in most deficiency most times. You can easily overstimulate plant foliage growth by too much nitrogen at the wrong time. So again, going back to your original premise of the question, you know, compost and so forth and mulch, both which you can make yourself, you know, and accumulate yourself, become great, you know, organic, long-term nutrients to amend your soil over the course of the years. Purchasing processed, synthesized fertilizer material or organic material may be indeed a very appropriate if you're trying to get that right balance of nutrients to the plant at the particular point in the plant's life cycle that is going to be most appropriate.
Okay, and now you also brought in a couple other visual aids today, and it looks like you have a potting soil selection, and is that a manure tea you have there?
No, this is actually soil from the garden. So what I'm exhibiting here is a very simple thing that home gardeners can do to actually sample their soil, look at the soil texture and composition. And it's actually taking a soil sample, you know, from across the garden, and placing it in a 4-to-1 mixture of water in a closed container, which we have here as mason jars, and letting it settle out so that you actually can see the composition of your sand, your silt, and your clay particles. And so what you're looking for, and again, these samples here will actually settle out over the course of, and of course they've been mixed up as we've traveled over here, but over the course of an hour or so, you'll actually see the sand settling at the bottom, the silt mixture as your next higher level, and then the clay particulates, which are very, very tiny, floating at the top and gradually settling down. What you're looking for and what your ideal soil is all about is a relatively equal mix of sand, silt, and clay. And then, of course, what you also want to see at the top is organic matter floating at the top. And so one of the simple things to do is to take samples of your own garden, let that soil sample out, and then also take some potting soil and see that you would purchase processed potting soil and see how that compares to your own mixtures.
You have one more visual aid that you brought in. Now, it's a plant in a pot, and I'm going to guess, is that an alder tree?
That is a tiny little alder tree that we brought in specifically to show the beneficial nature of some native plants like alder or like the traditional cover crops and how they are used to fix nitrogen. So you often see alders growing, one of the first plants growing in logged over areas or in gravel roads even, where the soils are just ostensibly awful. But because bacteria affix themselves to the roots of alder trees, these particular species of bacteria will actually fix the nitrogen in the air to the nitrogen that the plants needs, that the nitrates in particular, the kind of form of nitrogen that plants need to be absorbed. And so this is what we'll show at the workshop are the actual nodules at the end of the roots that actually are the bacteria colonies that are actually there taking nitrogen out of the atmosphere, converting it into nitrogen that the plants can use. Using this as an example of why cover crops are so important, especially around here, to actually naturally restore nitrogen to the soil and amend the soil for more beneficial use.
So on Saturday's workshop, you're going to learn the basics of soil composition, amending the soil to make it better, and then appropriate plantings, or are you going to go that far?
We won't go to plantings. We'll actually be talking about various pH recommendations for various types of plants. We'll be talking about different fertilizers. We'll be talking about composting, making sure that, you know, if you're not composting today, you ought to be thinking about it and making use of it. Truly trying to give an appreciation for the tremendous ecosystem that soil is, and trying to make sure that you're communicating it's a very living and vibrant, you know, ecosystem, as opposed to an inert set of dirt.
We're down to the last minute or so, so let's hear more about the workshop and the hands-on portions of the proceedings.
Right now, the format that we've been using for 2013, and it seems to have worked, so we're going to continue with that, is that we have the lecture part inside the museum from 10 to 11, and then from 11 to 1, depending upon what needs are for the garden, which is right next to the museum, we will get the volunteers that came to the lecture to help with, you know, whatever we're focusing on. For example, one of the workshops we had last year was on pruning techniques, and of course, after the lecture was over, we all went out and experimented or practiced with the trees and shrubs in the garden. And we will do something similar to that this Saturday as well. And we're counting on pretty nice weather, as we usually have had up to this point in our workshops and our hands-on practice. At the same time, in a different room, we also sponsor a plant clinic from 10 to 1 as well. And people who may not necessarily be interested in the lecture part of it can come and have a master gardener try to solve whatever the person's plant problem is. So that's going on at the same time.
So for a particular exercise this weekend, this Saturday, we'll actually be doing a little bit of pruning, a little bit of pruning, cleaning up. We've got some fertilizing, so we'll actually be putting to practice some of the fertilizing lecture notes that we'll be talking about. And we'll actually be taking some soil samples. In addition, there's some areas of the garden that need to be composted and mulched. And so we'll actually be laying down cardboard to actually kill some grass and prepare some new beds. Laying down cardboard and putting mulch and wood chips on top of that cardboard so as to create over time, right, a new garden area for new plantings this next fall.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Just one more thing. The master gardeners of both Washington State and Oregon are focused on research-based information. So the information that you're receiving at any of the workshops that happen in Pacific County and also in Clatsop County are all research-based information. And we are volunteers to our respective state universities to be volunteers and to promote that information to the public.
So both from on behalf of both OSU and WCU Master Gardeners, you know, is there anyone interested in becoming a Master Gardener and participating in the Master Gardener program should reach out and consider engaging with the training and joining us.
So you can find out more information about the Master Gardener program at this workshop as well, or from your county extension agent?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Well, Bev and Kelly, thank you so much for coming in.
Our pleasure.
And that is all the time we have for today's edition. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.